you're listening to The Seventh Reel. This week, Chinatown, a 1974 film directed by Roland Polanski. Roman Polanski. Jesus. Yusuf, this was your pick. Elaborate.
So I love this movie, and I wanted to write about it. So I thought this would be a good chance for us to like talk through the ideas and the history of the movie. And also I read a book about it, so I know quite a bit.
I'm very much looking forward to this episode. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've seen the movie the whole way through. I tried watching at university, couldn't get past the first 10 minutes. Maybe I just wasn't in the right mindset, but oh my god, this movie's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first like? You obviously loved this movie. You've seen many times. When was your first like encounter with it?
I think the first time I saw it, I was 15, and Subway had just opened up in Egypt, and so I got Subway and I watched it. I have a very vivid memory of eating Subway and then being like, you know what? I'm gonna watch this movie. It looks cool. And so forever, Subway and this movie are tied together.
How did it play to you when you were 15?
It was kind of boring for a bit. Because I do remember the stuff where it was like the water, like logistics of it being like, okay, well, I don't understand
what's going on with the dam.
But the mystery stuff was really interesting. And then I also remember that I downloaded it in two parts. So it splits, which is so interesting, because it splits during the love scene, like the sex scene, and then you start up and it's the when they get out of bed and he follows her. And I read in the book that was they split the script in half, and that was the midway point. The love scene was the midway point. So I don't know if that was deliberate, if someone was downloading the files, or if it was just like random happenstance, but that was so interesting to me.
But it is an interesting split, because that's when it's after that love scene, when the revelations start really coming through. Every single scene afterwards is just finding out the information. Everything's upended.
Yeah. It's like when he starts to uncover, actually, what's going on. Like,
kind of brutal movie about like how corruption ultimately is... encases this entire city from top to bottom, and that
it's built on like stolen land and not only that, which is I guess most of North America, but it's like
it's true,
it's one of the more interesting cities, because again they talk about like the inspiration of it is that Robert Towne was starting to read like Raymond Chandler again and loved all those noirs, and then his wife got him a book about LA. And then they started to... This is a real thing that happened with the...
The dam?
The dam and the, like, starving out the farmers and, like, actually... Like all this was a real thing. And it was kind of interesting because they talk about how it's a fake city. It's supposed to be, like, Arizona. But it's all, like, irrigated and all this is, like, manufactured.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
And that reflects visually as well, I think, with the movie. There's so many beautiful shots of American infrastructure juxtaposed against the vast emptiness of the Californian desert. There's like these shots where he's standing and there's just this massive dam and then just nothing stretches forward. Everything's fabricated. We're laughing because we have a surprise visitor today in the form of a cat. She's being very quiet. Never mind.
Yeah.
But there's so many shots of that. It feels almost like
it was very
mythological
deliberate.
In terms of just how big these structures are.
The location scout and costume designer, all people like that Robert Evans hired were like a huge part of the movie. That's something that goes like unsaid. That this is kind of more their movie than it is anyone's. Like structurally. Polanski's in charge, but from what I understood from the book is that he was like, okay, you go do your thing, pick out everything, and we'll just like follow your lead. Because I think even the guy who was the costume designer ended up heading a studio after that, but they were like experts at it, and they picked like all the like really like even the fans, the lamps, mm-hmm. everything was like era appropriate.
Yes, it's an amazing period movie. And the cars and everything.
Yeah, they looked through locations where I think the vision that they had in mind was like that it was so dry and like mm-hmm. hot, and so they wanted like everything to reflect that.
And visually, the sun too. It's all basked in the Californian sun. It's mm-hmm. this arch. It reminded me a lot of the cinematography in The Look of Babylon, with like the way the sun just kind of cakes everything. It's always this beautiful sunset, but it's so insidious.
Yeah.
And I love how, it, as the movie goes on, more of it takes place during the night. Like, the sun is gone. Everything is just like, oh, so brute and so sad. Michelle, what did you think? You thought it was kind of boring. Right,
Michelle.
Yeah, but I was like, had a long day at work. Oh, okay. Falling asleep. It was not the
I mean, and noirs aren't your favorite. Yes. You don't like noirs that much, so that makes sense.
But I like there's many layers to the mystery, right? There's, of course, the commentary of them redirecting the water and everything. Oh, the cat is biting Yusuf's feet, for reference. And then there's also the very, the internal, the mystery of, like, who was this girl? What's the relationship between the girl and the mogul?
Yeah.
Whose idea was the, is, I was the, there, I read that there was a different ending.
Yeah. I think the ending was that she doesn't die.
Yes.
But when Polanski came on, the script changed dramatically. Like, it, he really, and you kind of see that in the difference between the first movie and the second movie. The second movie has a voiceover. It's
more like, traditional noir.
Yeah, and it's a lot like True Detective Season 2, where it's like a million things are going
happening
on
at the same time.
And you're like, what the hell am I supposed to be following here? But this one's like very streamlined, very
focused. You
follow
one thing. And you never leave his perspective. I love that. It's like, oh, you know as much as he knows. And he thinks he knows everything. Yeah, and which is so funny. And how clueless he is and how completely helpless he is to even... He doesn't even solve the case. And the police aren't even interested in solving the case.
Bad for the grass. Yeah. Bad for the glass. Yeah. He solves it, sort of, right?
Does anyone come under justice? Like, no. Like, that's...
But that's one of the things that I wanted to explore in the essay, was that it's kind of a movie that was reworked by a guy who... His wife
went through something.
His wife got murdered, and there was, like, some form of justice, but it was very hollow, and he just doesn't get his, like, wife or child back.
They're gone. Yeah. I wasn't expecting her to get plugged through the eye. That was brutal. Just shot through the...
Yeah. You know what's weird? A couple of different things I want to mention.
Right.
So, when they shot her through the eye, he kept adding blood and stuff. And he had a very bad relationship with Faye Dunaway. He hated her. So her to suffer in the movie. The whole cast actually hated her because she was a real diva about it.
Oh.
Like, she would make the costume designers wait and stuff, and like would always like be late. And
what the fuck do you think you are? Like, this one's okay.
So they all clapped when she got shot. And a weirder, and on that note, you know, when in Macbeth, the guy, when he goes, and I think Macduff, who discovers his family got slaughtered or whatever? Anyways.
Yes, that's
he.
Yeah.
When he was telling him, I should play it this way, and Roman Polanski was like, no, don't play it that way, play it this way. And he was like, no, but I really think you should play it this way. And then Roman Polanski yelled at him and was like, I know what it's like. You don't know what you should play it as. And that was like a very telling. But back to this movie, you know Robert Towne, what he named his daughter, or his first daughter? Catherine. She's kind of gross, you know? After the incest. And his wife didn't put it together until later when they were divorced.
His wife just like, wait a second, you named your kid what? You son of a bitch. You
fucking asshole. It's so weird.
What's the incest stuff in the original script? Was that part
that,
of the
that came before anything.
Oh,
yeah, which
boy.
Is so interesting, right?
Because like, that was such a dark, dark twist. I wasn't expecting... I knew, kind of know what the twist is just by cultural osmosis. I know, like, is my sister and my daughter. Yeah,
my
remember that.
And my daughter.
But the way it's just comes out of nowhere, and it's so scary at the end when the father was like holding the little girl. It's like, oh, it's okay, it's okay. And you know he just got her back. He just, oh, that's just so sad. And scary. It's like I feel so slimy after watching it. And ultimately, it's like, you can't do anything. Forget about it. Forget it.
I love how when he says, like, most people don't understand that as if they're under the right circumstances, they could do anything as possible or something. That was kind of an interesting justification.
Mm.
That he knew that it was wrong, and yet he was like, but I can't stop it. Yeah. You know? That was an interesting character choice, I think.
Lots of great performances in this. And Jack Nicholson's fantastic. Polanski himself shows up.
Yeah, he's really good.
He was really good. He was very intimidating. And we keep thinking about the knife.
We were talking about that. That was such a deliberate, like, and specific thing. It feels real.
Yeah.
In the sequel, he has a scar.
I really thought he hurt his nose. Like, I thought it was like a thing. I swear my dad told me he really hurt his nose.
Well, I was telling Arvin this. In the book, he was really worried about the thing not going off right. Like, the stunt not going off right. And Polanski was very mean-spirited and kept, like, taunting him. I was like, oh, maybe we switched the wrong but me, I don't know, maybe, and kept scaring him with it and playing around with it. It's just like, he's such a mean guy.
My favorite Jack Nicholson moment is this, when he was on the phone and he's like oh yeah, I think you know the girl on that, and he's like, I think you know me, I'm the one who pretended to be like the girl, like the husband.
Oh, he's like shut the fuck up. Yeah, I love that.
He's so good. He just suddenly realized, oh, he just know, like, this is important now.
He's a great actor. I think he gets like portrayed a lot as like, oh, he's the crazy guy. He does the crazy
work. But he disappears he's a normal, kind of normal guy here.
The only glimpse of that you get is when he's telling the joke, which I'm curious about that. What is that? What's the significance?
It feels like a sitcom moment. It's like, aha, she's behind you. Aha, and you keep telling the joke. That felt like a completely different, like, off kilter.
But here's another thing I was, like, kind of confused by. Because he kept, like, the original script was 180 pages long. But, and I don't think any of it took place in Chinatown. But what inspired Robert Town also was, like, that he was talking to a cop friend of his. And he was explaining that in LA they didn't do much in Chinatown. Because they were, like, we don't know if we're helping someone stop a crime or helping someone commit a crime. So we just tend to stay out of it and let them govern their own land. But there's no place, there's no, like, Chinatown scenes. And that scene at the end was added.
That's the only time they actually do go back to Chinatown.
Yeah, it wasn't even in the original script. And so he kept saying, like, Chinatown is a state of mind. But then when you watch the movie, since there's not much Chinatown in it.
That's kind of how I feel about it, though. Because he keep bringing it up. That's his past, right? His past as a cop is in Chinatown. It's like, I don't want, he knows it's bad there.
But is it relevant enough to, like,
I think it's
forced. That's what I thought. It does.
You know what actually feels forced to me was when he goes back to the guy in the beginning to help, to get him to help him to, like,
Curly?
I was like, oh, so it's the movie thing. He's like, you show it in the first, but I was like, you don't need that, need that to come back, to bring that back. The
Chekhov thing?
The Chekhov's gone. If you show it, you gotta show it firing. But I do kind of get why they have to return to Chinatown because of that ending, because this is the only location where it could happen, where anything, like, this is what LA is. It's like an embodiment, Chinatown, right?
So maybe it's like the rules are off, so you can't.
The rules are off. There is no justice. You don't, like, the cops aren't really cops. Like, I love that it was like, he owns the cops. Like, nothing here. You're not doing anything here, and that's why the ending. We're like, forget, like, just forget it. It's Chinatown. You can't change anything.
But it felt just because all the help was either Asian. And then the Chinese.
Yes, that was China true. I noticed that. I was like, that is a very interesting choice. What is
he? He comes back. The wait, not the waiter. The guy who's like the servant.
Mm-hmm. He does.
He's in the sequel.
Oh, he's in the sequel. Yeah, that's awesome.
He hunts him down. He's like something about Catherine. And he's like, she gave away, and he's like the portrayed as this wise old Asian man serving him tea and stuff. Like, it fades in on the teapot. And it's so dumb.
I think the reason to feature the Asian population very prominently because they do play a huge role in establishing California as it is during that time. There was a huge Asian immigration, like, coming in during San Francisco, and during that period of time from the 1880s to just the 1930s. It's a significant chunk of LA and, by extension, California culture.
But what about, like, the Mexicans?
That's
why
true.
Why is it not called Mexico Town? And it's like
Chinatown sounds a bit cooler.
See, Señor.
Señor Chan.
You cannot take your sister.
Ignore it, sister. Ignore your amana.
Like it just felt like, I mean, okay, what you're bringing up actually makes more sense now. Because I was like, why Chinatown? That's so specific and odd. And it feels forced.
Because, they do play the big role in the development of that state. So I suppose that's why it's there.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to bring up to prepare for your writing?
No. I mean, let me quickly look at the stuff I wrote. So the title of my essay was "Don't Get Lost in Chinatown," which was the original title of the script.
Very movie. Clever.
Something about Polanski coming back because this was the only movie he wanted to make in LA. He was too scared to go back.
Oh.
But when they offered him that, it was he was like, "Oh, I'd love to make an LA movie with Paramount," because he grew up watching The Glass Key, The Maltese Falcon, all those Paramount noirs. The time between the murder solved in real life, Sharon Tate's murder, was 5 months. So he didn't know what was going on for 5 months. The Jake character is in the dark for
the entire movie, effectively.
Yeah, when the Manson family were arrested and were sentenced to be executed, the California appealed the death penalty a year after the guilty verdict, so they were not. And the movie comes out in, 74?
74, yeah.
And they were 70, so that's in 70, so... No justice, yeah.
No justice.
Polanski's friend Frykowski was a drug smuggler, or was involved with a bunch of drug smugglers. And when he came back, he met with that guy before he went to the airport, and was never mentioned in the Puglia. Mm-hmm. What's his name? The guy who wrote the book about the murders, the Helter Skelter book.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the police reports, because so they think that he thought something was off initially. This is getting into the conspiracy theories. But Jake was not aware of any of this before he got into it. Jake was swept into a swamp.
Yeah, it's just this guy surrounded by this mass. It's conspiracy that keeps unfolding, and he can't ever.
Yeah,
you can't see justice. You can't see answers.
The parallels, which I'm kind of. This is what I was hinting at in the conspiracy stuff, because he meets with the drug guy. Right. The drug guy had to have known that what they found out later was that the FBI was monitoring the house, and that Manson was theoretically maybe an informant. What Jake is caught up in is a thing where it involves the police, or the police don't even matter. And they can't rely on them.
In fact, the police hinders it.
Yeah, so that's the same thing where it's sort of a, no, come on, no! Well, you're stepping on the essays. Okay, well, that's it. Anyways, the point is the justice is fleeting. It's odd.
For clarity, dearest audience, Yusuf is currently being harassed by a cat. So, okay, that kind of brings us to the end of our first segment. Let's take a break.
All right, let's do it.
And we're back. Now step right up. 7 reels. What we're rating it? I'm going to go first. I'm going to give it a 6.5 reels out of 7.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's awesome. I can totally see why this is as influential as it is. And so sad, which I like.
Super sad.
The sadder it is, the higher the reels, you know? How about you, Michelle?
A 5.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. What drags it down?
For a noir, that's good.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
It wasn't fun, yeah.
It's not supposed to. It's supposed to reflect reality.
It's supposed to be about a man processing grief.
It's just slow, and I didn't get much out of it.
Hmm. Well, that kind of brings us to what we've been watching this week. What have we been watching this week?
I'm watching that Steven Soderbergh show, Full Circle.
You recommended?
I highly recommend it. It's it's really good.
What
I
think you should do more of that. The new Mission
Impossible. We saw the new Mission Impossible.
Oh, right.
Uh, It was fun. I liked it. I know we saw it at 10:30, and so we went on. We got out of the theater at 1.
I was very sleepy.
Yes. I like the set pieces. They did something unforgivable in the movie, which I will never forgive the director for doing.
What?
They killed off my favorite character.
Oh.
I was so upset. He owned one of the half the reason why I wanted to watch
it. I think it was because she was busy with other projects.
Yeah, right? She has that Silo show now that your friend recommended.
Who? Raja?
No, Ali.
Oh, he liked.
He talked about it when we were afterwards.
But he likes any sci-fi show, anything. Like
that's cool.
If it's like
bad.
Yeah, he'll be like, okay, I'll watch.
It was fine. We watched Mamma Mia, Michelle and I.
Here we go again.
Just the first one. The one with Meryl Streep. She actually shows up.
Wait, she's not in the second.
No, she's not.
Who's in the second one?
They got Lily James to play the younger version of her. So the story flashes back between. Like that's how it's structured. But it's very, you know what I will say about Mamma Mia? Everybody looked like they were having fun. Pierce Brosnan, I've never seen him have so much fun in the movie. He was big smiles. He was having a great time. Skellen Skarsgård was having a great time.
I do love those kinds of movies occasionally because, it's complicated or as good as it gets. Or what's the other ones? Like any of the Nancy Meyers movies.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much they're relaxing.
Yeah, and at the end, everybody comes out to do a concert, and it feels like they love this. Like they all stream and they're like, "You want to hear another one? Let's do another one." I'm like, "Let's do another one! Hell yeah!" They sing Waterloo, and they bring all the guys out in stupid costumes. Fantastic!
It's just a good time.
It's just a good time.
You know, you relax.
Mixed messaging regarding like a woman's autonomy.
Are you an ABBA fan?
Yeah, they're
all hits.
Okay, you're not like, I love ABBA.
But he's the one who wanted to watch Mamma Mia.
He's a musical head, right?
Yeah.
He loves music.
There are at least like 5 crash zooms into Skellen Skarsgård's face. Every time it happens, I laugh. It's very funny.
He was like, Michelle, let's watch Mamma Mia. And you were like, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, can we look for something else?
We were looking for something for like 10 minutes. I wasn't...
10 minutes does not justify Mamma Mia.
Alright, well, that brings us to what are our recommendations. I'll go first. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Ooh.
I think it's a fantastic juxtaposition to this because that's about the death of that particular age of, and this is hearkening the beginning of a new, like, things moving forward.
That's so true.
The fantasy is over. The dream is over.
The death of New Hollywood.
The death of New Hollywood, and I love that. And after watching this, I realize how sad Once Upon a Time is. It really is like a love letter to a Hollywood that never was. Like you wish the party never ended. But even in the movie, the party ends, right? When they're talking about like Rick moving on and the Rolling Stones song, babe, you're out of time. Like, so sad.
But I thought that was more about like the hippie generation taking over and Rick, the old guy, understanding that his time is up. But that's, I mean...
Yeah, I agree with that. But it's also like, because the Manson stuff is at the end, and we all know, he knows and you know what actually happens.
Oh, yeah.
And we're out of time, we're just rocketing towards this inevitable conclusion until he chooses to subvert that.
Something like that was bound to happen. With all those drugs and all of those, like the thing I took away from the Chaos book is that they were like always like, you didn't know if someone was an intellectual or someone was just like some druggie.
Yeah,
anyways.
Michelle, what's your recommendation?
I don't know.
Mamma Mia. Here I go again.
I keep thinking of the French Connection Bad Boys. Because I'm there.
Bad Boys.
the two classics.
Two classics.
No, but French Connection makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay? Because of the...
Use that one.
Paranoia.
Yeah.
And the conspiracy.
What's yours?
I have two recommendations.
All right, let's hear it.
One is very straightforward. The Two Jakes.
Sequel.
Yeah, a hilarious title, the first thing.
Why are they two Jakes? Can you explain that?
Harvey Keitel plays a guy named Jake the Villain in the movie.
King
yeah.
So dumb.
And he's Jewish, apparently.
Oh, God.
Harvey Keitel plays a Jewish guy. It's really funny. It's about oil this time.
Oh.
It's about, like, oil lands. Anyways, whatever. So that's it's worth watching because of how bizarre and, like, how interesting, it was supposed to be a trilogy, but
second one was so bad they just never got the third one.
Because I think initially they Jack Nicholson does, it's not a bad job of directing it. There are a couple of really interesting shots, honestly.
He directed it?
Yeah, yeah, it was really good. But the script is Robert Town, and it's more like what the original sounded like, and it's really bad.
It lacks the edge.
Yeah, it's not like streamlined. It's not like, you know, just like a bullet train, like all of the other Polanski movies, like they're very to the point.
Chan-ho moves very quickly. Every single scene, you're learning something new until you start learning it backwards. And
but this one, it was just all over the place. But there's a hilarious sex, like it's the funniest. I'm gonna show it to you after.
Awesome, I can't wait.
So that one, and the other one, a movie that came out on the around the same time was The Long Goodbye. Which is a different like noir by the new Hollywood guys. The Altman movie is fascinating because it's like also it's like a Raymond Chandler inspired. It's actually like based on Raymond Chandler book. And
is it also set in the 30s?
No, that's the thing. He updates it. He sets it in the 60s. And so a lot of people, I read a couple of essays where it was like, oh, these two movies were by new Hollywood guys. And they were about noirs, but one took a very different approach of like setting it like in an older time period and making it a period piece, but having it be just as cynical. And the other one is as cynical, but it's set in the current time period. And I think there are a lot of interesting parallels there, which a viewer might reach on their own time. So anyways.
Cool. Well, those are two very excellent recommendations. Whose turn is it to pick?
Yours.
I think it is yours.
I was just realizing that as soon as I was like, oh shit, it's like, my turn to pick. I don't want to subject you guys to any bad movies.
You wanted us to watch The Shining.
Ooh, you know what? No, it's so long. It's such a long. Yeah, it's like 2 hours. It's like 2 hours 30. Yeah.
We could watch Barbie Oppenheimer and do an episode on that.
We're gonna do All right, next episode. We're finally caving into the masses. Barbenheimer.
But again, it's your pick.
We're gonna do Barbenheimer. Then we don't need to watch anything separately. That's my pick. I was gonna subject you guys to Shin Godzilla, but I don't think any of you guys will actually enjoy it.
Okay, then we're doing Barbenheimer. Michelle and I.
All right, Barbenheimer, everybody. Catch you later, Barbie. Bye. I am Death, the destroyer of Barbie. Box offices. Okay. All right. Bye bye. The 7th Reel is hosted by Arvin Huang, Michelle Hassel, and Yusuf El-Bashir. Logo by Joe Conti. Our ad break music is composed by Yusuf Sui Lim, and our outro music is composed by Yahya El-Bashir. Thanks for listening.